brown paper bag.
Shut up about the donuts. Murph doesn't want your donuts. Murph wants you to answer his questions.
Then when's he gonna ask a question?
Shut up, Martin! I'm asking the questions here.
That's kinda my point.
Shut up, shut up, shut up!
Miller sat down and panted for a while. Murphy just stared at Martin. Finally, Special Agent Miller continued.
Look, kid, we're Treasury agents. Until recently, we used to investigate bank fraud, and we were good at it.
Too good, Murph said.
That's right, Murph. Too good. We were so good we got promoted to a special task force. A small task force. Elite, they call it.
How many agents are on our task force again, Murph?
Two.
Two agents. Me and my partner, Murph. I'd say that's pretty freaking elite. We investigate the bank fraud cases where nobody can figure out what the fraud was. Even the bank that got defrauded. That means that before we can start solving a crime, we gotta figure out if there was a crime at all. That's why we're here, Martin. To try to figure out if you've committed a crime.
They sat in silence for a moment.
Have you committed a crime, Martin?
Another silent moment passed.
No.
Good! Glad to hear it, Miller said. Perhaps you can tell us how you managed to put five separate sums of money, totaling more than $23,000, in your bank account without making a deposit or a transfer.
Martin had never stopped to add up all of the cash he'd created.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Not really,
Special Agent Miller said.
Normally it takes more than $100,000 to get our attention. It was the number of times money just showed up that made the bank suspicious.
This news did not make Martin happier.
I'm screwed, he thought. The jig is up, all the way up. Even if I get out of this, they'll be watching me for the rest of my life. My best case scenario is that I get to go back to my life the way it was. Only now I'm unemployed and gave all my furniture to Goodwill. At least I can buy it back for cheap. It won't come to that, though. They'll pin something on me. I'm going to prison. Oh, I can't see how I can get out of this.
So you gonna tell us, Martin?
Martin had been so absorbed in his misery, he'd nearly forgotten the men in the room with him.
Pardon?
He asked, startled. Special Agent Miller smiled.
My partner Murph and I were wondering if you'd tell us how you got all that money into your account without depositing, transferring, or even earning it, as near as we can tell.
Martin perked up instantly.
No! I'll do better than tell you! I'll show you! All I need is for you to bring me my smartphone.
Agent Murphy stood up, and with a bright smile said,
Will do! I'll be right back.
7. Martin materialized in his apartment with his thumb on his phone app's home button, the police evidence bag containing his wallet, belt, and shoelaces in his other hand, and a big smile on his face. The smile faded as he fell to the ground, again landing directly on his tailbone. He cursed himself for not having the foresight to stand before he teleported. Luckily, the federal agents searching his apartment didn't see him fall. They only heard him hit the floor. The agent sitting at Martin's desk searching the new computer slowly turned around. He and Martin made eye contact for a moment. Then Martin sprinted out the front door. As he passed the bedroom, another agent peeked around the corner. Martin raced out the door and made for the parking lot, cornering as best he could in his unlaced sneakers. He was happy to see they hadn't towed his new car yet. He got in and tore out of the parking lot as quickly as he could, narrowly missing a bedraggled old man on a beat-up bicycle. He knew where he was going, and happily it was only a couple of miles away. That didn't leave him much time to think, but he'd have all the time he needed to think soon. Possibly too much. Now was the time for action. He looked in the rearview mirror and was not surprised to see two dark, unmarked cars with flashing lights concealed in their grills closing on him. He sped up, not even entertaining the notion of getting away. He just needed to keep them from getting in front of him. Martin knew he was going to escape. Where he was going to escape to, and where he was going to escape from, were the questions. He didn't want to teleport out of a moving car. He'd made a big enough mess without risking injuring or killing someone. He also didn't want to teleport with anyone watching. He knew that Murphy and Miller had likely recorded his first disappearing act, but one video of an inexplicable event, witnessed by the two men who made the video, and who would be embarrassed to have let a kid in his mid-20s escape, would probably look suspect. If he also disappeared in a public place with multiple federal agents watching, that would be hard to explain away. Martin hoped he would get a moment of privacy to grab the things he needed and think about where he wanted to escape to. Martin continued driving the speed limit. He figured that as long as he didn't seem to be a danger to anyone, his pursuers wouldn't risk the public safety to stop him. Whatever he was going to do, he needed to do it quickly. The two unmarked cars were now accompanied by at least three squad cars, all with their lights flashing and sirens blaring. He was only a few blocks from his destination, and if he didn't do something to put some distance between him and his pursuers, he'd never get away. Martin's shiny red hatchback led its loud, ugly parade through the quiet suburb where he grew up. Martin blew through a stop sign. A ticket for a moving violation was the least of his worries. He pictured his sentencing. 20 years for bank fraud, followed by traffic school.
All the more reason not to get caught, he thought.
He got an idea that he hated immediately, but it was the only idea he had. There was only one turn remaining before he reached his destination, a 90-degree left onto the street where he grew up. He had always avoided using his phone while driving, but in this case, he made an exception. He pulled up the app and hit the tab with the compass on it. The phone displayed a satellite map of his surroundings. He selected a spot fairly close to where he wanted to be. The final turn loomed. His thumb hovered over the screen as he floored the gas pedal of the brand new car and aimed it for a huge tree he used to walk past on the way to school each morning. He glanced at the phone in his right hand, making sure his thumb was going to hit the right spot.
If I time this right, he thought, I get away. If I don't, maybe they'll chalk it up to texting while driving.
The car jumped the curb, and in the last second before hitting the tree, his thumb hit the screen. It was a work day in the suburbs, so nobody was outside to see Martin appear in the middle of the street in a seated position, suspended a foot off the ground. Martin fell straight down to the road beneath him. Again, his weight landed on his still-healing tailbone. As he fell, he heard the surprisingly hollow crunching noise of his car hitting a tree 2 blocks away. He scrambled to his feet and peered into the distance. He saw what was left of his car wrapped around the base of the tree. He smiled as he saw the police vehicles pull up to the wreck, all sense of urgency drained out of them. The federal agents who had torn his apartment to shreds stepped out of the black, unmarked cars and ran to the crumpled wreck to see if Martin needed a doctor or a coroner. Martin's happiness didn't last long. It was shattered by a blasting car horn from behind him. He spun and saw a green minivan approaching. He had forgotten that he was standing in the middle of the road. He lunged to the side of the road, looked back to the wreck, and his worst fears were realized. The agents heard the horn and had clearly recognized Martin, even at this distance. They were pointing in his direction and scrambling back into their cars. The minivan's driver, a mousy woman with a pinched face, gave Martin the stink eye as she drove past. But Martin never knew it. He was already sprinting across a yard and into a specific house, his chosen destination. Walter Banks sat on a large sofa in the living room of his home, a split-level ranch in the suburbs of Seattle. He was watching a rerun of an old sitcom. Back when he was working, he thought the show wasn't worth his time. Now that he and his wife were retired, him from Boeing, her from a desk job at the school district, and the kids were grown and out of the house, he had more time to spend on TV shows. This, he was learning, was not a good thing. He didn't know the name of the show he was watching, but he did know that it adhered to the standard sitcom template. Below-average-looking guy, married to stunningly beautiful woman, is unhappy. His wife, Margarita, who was roughly equal to him in attractiveness but had made him very happy, was in the kitchen doing whatever it was she was doing this week. If you asked her what her hobby was, she'd call it crafting. Crafting was a broad term, and every week she had some new thing she was making out of some new thing he wasn't allowed to throw away anymore, or which he had to go to the craft store and buy with her. They'd stand in the aisle of styrofoam balls, which was next to the aisle of big sheets of cardboard, and across from the aisle of fake ficus trees. It was the ficus trees that confused him.
What could anyone possibly make out of those?
TV wasn't holding his interest, so Walter went to see what his wife was up to. She was sitting at the dining room table with her back to the entryway. A large part of the table was covered with newspaper. On the newspaper, blobs of white clay were sitting, spaced evenly. As he got closer, he was confused by what he saw. He kissed his wife on the top of the head.
Margarita, what are you doing?
She turned and showed him what she was working on.
I'm sculpting little gooey duck clams. We can send them to our friends who live in other parts of the country. A little piece of the Northwest,
she said, holding up the one she was working on so Walter could appreciate it. Walter asked,
That's a clam? It's not done yet. I'm doing the necks first, and when they dry, I'll do the shells.
In the distance, they both heard the sound of multiple sirens, getting louder very quickly. Walter walked toward the front window to see what was going on, but only got two steps before they heard the hollow crunch of a collision. Walter went to the window and started to open the curtains, but the front door burst open, and their youngest son, Martin, burst into the house. Martin slammed the door shut and locked the deadbolt. He had a plastic bag in one hand.
Son?
Was all Walter had time to say before Martin had spun around and hugged him so firmly that it squeezed the breath out of him.
Dad, Mom, I need you to know two things,
Martin said. He released his father from the vice-like hug and advanced on his mother. He paused, confused at what his mother was holding, then hugged her much more gently than he had his father.
Just remember, I love you, and it isn't true.
He released his mother and walked toward the hall that led to his old bedroom.
It's not true that you love us?
His mother said in a quiet, confused voice.
What? No, I love you. Something else isn't true.
What isn't true?
His father asked. He had to shout, as the sirens were very loud now. Martin looked at the front window. He saw the color of the police lights filtering through the drawn curtains. He said,
You'll see soon enough.
He took one last look at his parents, then said, I'll be in my room. He walked into his boyhood bedroom and closed the door behind him. Martin felt bad for dragging his parents into this, but he knew they'd be fine. No evidence tied them to anything illegal, because there was no evidence of anything illegal. He'd securely wiped his old computer, and he hadn't done anything with the new one. He was taking his phone with him. His parents could afford a lawyer if it came to that, but there might still be a way to keep them from needing one. He needed time to think. Peeking out the window of his old bedroom, which looked out on the front yard, it was clear he'd get no time to think here. The two unmarked cars and three squad cars were crowding the street, lights flashing. The agent who had been monkeying with his computer saw Martin through the window and smiled. Martin wrenched the curtains closed. His eyes darted around the room. He dove for the closet. Any second he'd hear the agents pounding on the front door, and then he'd only have a few moments of freedom left. He saw what he was looking for in the closet, and he snatched it up, tucking it under his arm with his wadded-up jacket.
Well, here goes, he thought. Soon I'll have all the time to think I need.
As quickly as one would rip off a bandage or jump into the deep end of a cold swimming pool, Martin pulled out his phone, opened the app, and pressed the escape button. 8. In the distance, near the horizon, a bank of clouds was casting a shadow over what Martin couldn't quite believe was France. Here, though, the sky was a pale blue, with only a few clouds thrown in as if to add texture. The sea roared, as the sea always did, but it was a distant, hollow sound. Distant, because despite the fact that this spot was only 100 feet or so from the edge of the land, the actual point where sea met sand was at the base of a dizzying, chalk-white cliff. Here, on top of the cliff, a steady breeze blew the wild scrub grass and forced the seabirds to work for every inch of progress they made. On one side, the horizon was nothing but clouds and sea. On the other, the horizon was all gentle rolling hills and trees. Martin would have found it all very restful, if he hadn't known he was so utterly screwed. He sat on the ground right there where he had materialized and allowed himself to freak out. He alternated between panic, tears, and shame, waves of each rolling over his brain in random order and for indeterminate stretches of time. More than anything, he felt stupid. So very stupid. All he'd had to do was lay low. That was the whole plan. Two words. Lay low. So simple, but clearly too complicated for him. After a while, he started thinking instead of just feeling. He was in a mess. The first order of business was to figure out how to fix it. He listed his problems. No job. No cash. Bank account almost certainly frozen. Wanted by the police. parents aware of the first four items on this list. No food, no shelter. Exiled to medieval England. That established, he tried to prioritize the problems in order from least to greatest, and then spent an indeterminate amount of time feeling panic, shame, and sorrow again. Clearly, choosing which problem was worst was not productive. Instead, he tried to figure out which was the most urgent, which clarified things. He needed food and he needed shelter. All of the other problems were part of one big ball of problems. If he could make the ball of problems go away, the food and shelter issues would be a piece of cake. But he didn't know how to do that. His first impulse was to go back to his apartment, before the chain reaction of stupid decisions started. But he didn't think that would work. What would he tell himself?
Be careful, or you'll screw this up.
Past him already knew that. In fact, he remembered thinking almost those exact words. Also, if he were going to go to the future to warn past him, wouldn't he have already done it? When he went back in time to tell himself to go back in time and to play poker, his first experience of it was of seeing himself appear from the future, not of getting the idea to go to the past. If at any point in the future he were going to warn himself, at some point before now, he would have been warned by himself. Martin was angry with himself for not stopping himself from doing the stupid things he had done. He knew this was not rational, but he was beginning to suspect that rational thought was not his strong suit. For whatever reason, warning himself was not an option. He'd have to find some other way to fix the mess he'd left behind in the future. And since he had no idea what that would be, he'd have to bide his time here, in the past. That made the food and shelter problems clearly stand out from the rest, and for some reason that made Martin feel better. Also, he didn't have to worry about messing up the space-time continuum, because if he was going to, he already had, long before he was even born.
Okay, he thought. I know what my problems are. What are my assets?
He had his clothes. This was not a promising start, but there it was. His shoes were still unlaced. He dug the laces out of the plastic evidence bag Agent Murphy had handed him when he'd asked for his phone. As he laced his shoes, he continued down the list. He had his clothes. He had a jacket. He had his phone. He had his wallet full of plastic cards that were useless except as bookmarks. He had his car keys, which were equally useless here and in the future now that the car was totaled. He could stay in this time, go back to his time, or try any time in between. He could transport anywhere on the globe, but he'd have to be careful. He had picked the White Cliffs of Dover because they would be there. They had existed for millions of years, so they were a safe landing zone. Even that wasn't quite true, he saw. He had picked a landing spot about 30 feet from the cliff edge, but he materialized over 100 feet away. This might have been an error, or continental drift, or perhaps the cliff had eroded. Maybe it was a bit of all three. In any case, Martin couldn't guarantee that any geological feature would be where his mapping program said it was. He had considered picking a mountain peak as a landing zone, and now he was glad he hadn't. Imagine materializing in midair, 30 feet to the left of the peak. He shuddered at the idea. He could still teleport anywhere, but he'd need to be careful. He was in medieval England, which was both a problem and an asset. He chose this time and place as his escape hatch because he spoke English, and the people believed in magic. He could hover and teleport to prove his so-called powers. Heck, the phone itself would look like magic. He could just show it to people and they'd be convinced. His clothes would look strange, his manner would seem strange, and his English wouldn't be quite the same as the local dialect, which might just make him seem otherworldly. He had the plastic bag the agents had put his belongings in. The locals certainly would never have seen anything like that. Lastly, he had the thing he'd rushed home for, aside from seeing his parents one last time. He held it up to look at it, and was delighted that in his senior year he'd chosen to go to a Halloween party as Draco Malfoy from the Harry Potter movies. At the time, it was just an excuse to bleach his hair, which hadn't worked out. But now he had a dark robe with a snake sewn on it and a magic wand. He tried the robe on. He'd gained weight since high school, but the robe wasn't too tight. Well, it was too tight, but it wasn't too tight. He turned his back to the ocean and started walking. The plan was to find people, convince them he was a wizard, get food and shelter, then lay low while he made a plan. It was a simple plan, and it would work this time. He knew how not to do it.
Yes, sir, he thought. I'll just lay low. First step, find a bunch of people and convince them I have magic powers.
9. After an hour of walking, Martin crested a small hill. He hadn't covered as much ground as he'd hoped. Walking through wilderness, even when it's devoid of trees, takes more time and effort than walking on a sidewalk. He was irritated that nobody had ever mentioned this fact to him, but after some thought he realized that people who walk in undeveloped areas in his time did so mostly for fun, and if that was the case, having to spend more time doing it wouldn't be something they'd complain about. It was getting late in the afternoon. Soon it would be evening. And while he knew that people slept outdoors for millennia, he'd never done it himself. He had no idea what could attack him in the night, but he'd seen enough movies to have some ideas. Wolves. Highwaymen. Evil queens. He spent a lot of time thinking about being attacked by an evil queen. It actually didn't sound so bad. At any rate, he did not like the idea of spending the night outdoors. He knew that if things got really bad, he could go back to his own time, but he was still in big trouble there. Here, he was alone, tired, and hungry, but at least he wasn't being actively pursued. Besides, if things didn't start to look up here, he had all the rest of history to go to. He figured he'd give this time and place a shot and see how he liked it. He squared his jaw and thought,
Martin Banks, time tourist.
He reached the top of the hill and saw what might be a road in the distance, near the tree line. He figured it would take another hour at least to reach it. He could see a long way, and there were no other people anywhere. He pulled out his phone, made a quick estimate of the distance to the road, and a few seconds later, he was standing in the middle of it. This was more like it. The road was a set of two ruts that had been reinforced enough to effectively become one large rut. In one direction, the road disappeared into the woods. In the other, it continued in open grassland along the edge of the woods, allowing Martin to see nearly a half mile of empty road. He didn't know which direction would lead him to a village first, but he did know which direction he could travel more easily. A few seconds later, he was a half mile down the road. He spent the next half hour leapfrogging huge chunks of land. There were a lot of large, clear sections of road he could teleport past. In a few places, the road disappeared around a bend, but he'd see it reemerge in the distance, so he jumped to that spot, cutting who knew how much distance from his journey. He was getting discouraged that he hadn't seen any other people, when in the distance he saw what appeared to be two men on horseback riding towards him. They were still hundreds of yards away. He started walking toward them. He hoped to at least find out how far he was from the nearest village. As the distance between them slowly closed, he could see more detail. They were either men or powerfully unattractive women. They had swords. Honest to God swords! He could tell they had seen him. They didn't seem concerned. They weren't speeding up at all, and neither was Martin, but the distance between them seemed to be closing much faster than before, and each second brought new, unwelcome details. Their clothes were made primarily of leather and a fabric that looked scratchy. The colors were mottled, and by mottled he meant stained. The worst part was that they were both smiling. Martin knew that if they tried anything, he could hit the escape button again, and it would take him back to the cliffs, but all of his progress would be lost. He opened the app, hoping he wouldn't need it. He'd lived in the city long enough to know that to show any fear was the absolute worst thing he could do. He forced himself to smile and to walk faster toward the two. As he got closer, their smiles faded.
Maybe they think I'm going to attack them, he thought. I'm wearing a wizard robe.
He didn't want them to attack preemptively. He meant them no harm. He only wanted information about the nearest village. Martin decided to act friendly.
Hello!
Martin yelled, waving casually with his right hand, but holding his phone with the left, his thumb hovering over the escape button. The men leaned in closer and spoke to each other. They were about 100 feet away now and could really get a good look at Martin. Martin could also see them. He noticed that the two men shared 3 eyebrows and 3 working eyes between them, but the distribution was not uniform. They stopped their horses.
Maybe hello is too modern a word, Martin thought. They don't know what it means. I should be careful what I say.
He tried to remember how people greeted each other in ye olde times.
Hey, hail! Greetings!
He yelled, waving energetically. The two men seemed unnerved. They glanced at each other, then spurred their horses to an instant gallop. They passed Martin, giving him as much room as they could without riding into the woods.
Salutations! Well met! What ho!
A man who passed closest to Martin, one eye, two eyebrows, gritted his also non-traditional number of teeth and dug his heels into the horse's flanks again. Once they were past him, the men fled at top speed. Martin turned to watch them go and saw that a horse-drawn wagon was approaching him from behind.
It must have been in a part of the road I bypassed, he thought.
The two men passed the wagon without giving it any apparent thought. Martin watched the wagon's approach, wondering if the driver would be afraid of him too. The wagon was drawn by a single horse, and there appeared to be a single driver with no passengers. The driver seemed small and was wearing a hood. He couldn't see if anything was in the back of the wagon, which stopped 10 feet short of Martin.
At least this guy doesn't seem scared of me, Martin thought. I wonder what his eye-to-eyebrow ratio will be.
The driver removed her hood and said,
Good day.
She had brown hair, roughly but not inexpertly cut to shoulder length, and wide-spaced brown eyes. Martin noted a lack of makeup, which seemed odd to him until he took a half second to think about it.
I'm going to have to get used to that, he thought.
Her cloak was like a large hooded poncho, but with sleeves. It was charcoal gray over a long skirt the color of oatmeal. All of her clothes looked very soft and very warm. She was making eye contact and was smiling, which he found promising. Her teeth were whiter and straighter than he'd expected a medieval wench's teeth to be.
Good day,
Martin replied, then stared at her for a moment, unsure what to say next. The woman stared back. During his walk, Martin had thought about what demeanor he should maintain with the people he met in this time. He had settled on wise, mysterious, and commanding. In short, wizardly. This was his first chance to give it a shot.
Good lady,
he said in a voice that was louder than he'd intended.
Is there a town or a village nearby?
She continued to look him square in the eye and smile while considering her answer. Eventually, she said,
I.
Ah,
Martin said. He looked back down the road the way he came, then looked up the road the direction he was heading.
Is it far?
She said,
No, I expect to be there before dark.
Martin looked at her horse and wagon. The horse was smallish, but seemed healthy. The wagon looked primitive, but sturdy, with wheels that were solid wood discs. Most important, the horse and the cart were both pointing a specific direction. He pointed the same way.
The village is this way, then.
Aye.
All right, then. I guess I'll see you there. Okay. Good evening.
Martin took a step. The woman said,
Would you like to ride with me? The road can be dangerous, and I would not mind the company of a wizard.
Well, now we're finally getting somewhere, he thought as he pulled himself up onto the bench next to her.
The cart started moving. It was not a smooth ride, but it was far better than walking. He decided to try to listen more than he talked. He wanted to take in information, not give it away, but the young woman driving the cart seemed content to ride in silence. She was still smiling. She just wasn't talking. There was information Martin needed, and if he was going to get it, he'd have to start the conversation.
How did you know I'm a wizard?
That is a wizard's robe, is it not?
She asked, not turning to look at him.
Indeed, indeed it is. Yes, he said. Indeed.
They lapsed back into silence. After a time, Martin decided to try again.
I appreciate your offering me this ride, but aren't you at all afraid to be in the presence of a wizard such as myself?
No. If we are attacked, you'll likely be quite useful,
she said, still staring straight ahead.
Oh,
I understand why you'd be less afraid with me, but aren't you at all afraid of me?
Nay,
she said.
I'm just a seamstress and tailor. I have nothing to interest a wizard, just needles and thread. And I needn't worry about you ravishing me. Everyone knows wizards are celibate.
Martin didn't like hearing that. He changed the subject.
So, what can you tell me about the village we're going to?
It's the place where I live. It's not a mere village, but a good-sized town. Ledchurch, it's called. I'm sure you've heard of it. It's quite famous.
No, Martin said, remembering to use his grandiose voice. I've not heard of it. I am new to this land.
Oh, interesting,
she said, taking her eyes from the road to look at him for the first time since the ride began.
Where are you from? Time to try the cover story,
he thought.
The East, he said. You said Ledchurch was famous. What for?
The church, of course. 'Tis a fine church clad entirely in precious metal.
What precious metal?
Martin asked, his curiosity piqued.
Lead? What else? A precious metal indeed, most useful. We had to import it from the North Country. Pilgrims come from far and wide to gaze upon the church at high noon. It's a dazzling sight, the greyest thing you've ever seen. Some mark its exterior with their thumbnail. Children often lick its surface, but we try to discourage that.
So, is there much work for a wizard in Ledchurch?
She mulled this over.
I'd say so. Mind you, there's a wizard in Ledchurch already, but if you can prove your magic is equal to his, I bet you can keep food in your belly.
Splendid! I can't wait to see it.
He paused.
I'm sorry, I haven't introduced myself. My name is Martin.
And I'm Gwen,
she replied. They came to the edge of town. It was the most abrupt town edge Martin had ever seen. There was nothing but sparse woods, then a meadow, then a tight grouping of rough-hewn buildings with thatched roofs. Some had timber frames, others seemed to be made from piles of stone. Gwen stopped the wagon in front of a very noisy two-story building. There was a sign hanging over a door that had a painting of a tree stump.
This is where we part, Martin,
Gwen said, turning to face him.
This is the rotted stump. Here you'll find food, a bed, and plenty to keep you entertained. If you ever need any new garments made or alterations to your robe, please keep me in mind.
She reached into the bed of the wagon and produced a long stick with marks cut in it at regular intervals. She held it up to his arm, clearly measuring his sleeve. He thanked her and climbed down out of the wagon. His feet had barely touched the ground when she pulled away. The town looked exactly as he expected a medieval English town to look, except much more pleasant. The road was not a sea of mud, but a sort of large, loose gravel. He suspected that on a rainy day it got a little sloppy, but not much worse than some country driveways he'd seen. The buildings were small and made of wood, stone, and thatch, but they weren't shanties. There was even some glass, which surprised Martin. The lack of lighting was the main thing that differentiated them from modern buildings. Dusk was fading into night, and there was light in the windows, but it was dimmer and more uneven than he was used to. It looked like the entire town was having a romantic evening in. The people walking the street seemed healthy and happy. No obvious cases of severe scoliosis. People weren't scurrying in fear. It was a normal town, full of normal people, living without technology. Martin turned to face the inn. He listened to the sounds. Lively chatter was coming from the building, but he heard no anger or violence in the sound, which was reassuring. He took a moment to get his thoughts in order, then entered the inn. 10. At first glance, the inn was everything Martin expected, but different. It was dark, but not grim. All of the light came from candles, but there were a lot of them. The tables and chairs were similar to what he would call picnic tables and benches, but still totally recognizable to his modern eyes. There was a bar, but it was more of an extra-large table. The bartender was a heavy man in a dirty tunic. His right arm was missing, just above the elbow. On his bar, there was a wooden box with rough metal hinges. The cash box, Martin assumed. Next to the barkeep's stool, there was a barrel with the lid on, but slightly askew, and the handle of a metal ladle sticking out. The customers were mostly men, though not by a very big margin. Mostly large, and that included the women, and mostly drunk, but there were no fights in progress and no sense of menace.
It's just a bar, Martin thought.
He felt comfortable enough to continue. Martin said,
"Excuse me,"
in a loud, clear voice. All sound ceased instantly, and every head turned to look at him. Someone groaned.
"I'm sorry to interrupt your evening," Martin continued, "but I just wanted to let you all know that I'm a powerful wizard."
The bartender turned to a young boy standing near the barrel and said,
"You'd best get Philip."
The boy nodded and sprinted out the back door.
"Who's Philip?"
Martin asked.
"Local wizard. He want to welcome you,"
the barman replied. Martin heard a few quiet chuckles from the back of the room. He was pleased, though. This charlatan who was calling himself a wizard would come in, spout some mumbo-jumbo, and do some stupid trick. Then Martin would show them real magic. He'd start small, show them the plastic bag, then move on to the smartphone. If he needed the big guns, he'd levitate, but he didn't want to use that if he didn't have to.
"So, you wanted us to know that you're a wizard. Now we know. What of it?"
"I was thinking that if I demonstrate my powers, you might give me food and a place to sleep for the night."
The barman stroked his stubbly chin with his left and only hand as he rose and walked to Martin.
"Interesting offer you make, young master wizard. I think if I were a powerful wizard, I'd offer to not demonstrate my powers if I was given what I want, if you see what I mean."
"I'm not trying to threaten anyone," Martin said.
"And you haven't. You just barged in and asked for free room and board without doing us the courtesy of threatening us with your magic."
I'm sorry," Martin sputtered.
"As well you should be. You don't just prance into an inn and demand free food and a bed simply because of who you are. It's not done. Look at Gert!"
The bartender turned to the back of the room.
"Gert, come here!"
A woman at the back of the room took a long time getting up from her seat. She rose at normal speed, but there was so much of her that it still took a long time. Once she was up, she walked quickly to where Martin and the innkeeper stood. Again, she moved at normal speed, but her stride was so long it only took a few steps. Gert smiled benevolently and put a hand on Martin's shoulder. The sheer weight of it made Martin squirm. She was all muscle. Her fingers were stronger than most men's arms. Martin looked up into her mammoth eyes. They looked sad. The look in her eyes said that she would not enjoy hurting Martin, and she would not enjoy it soon.
"Are you looking at Gert?"
the innkeeper asked.
"Yes, sir, I am."
"Good. It might not surprise you to learn that some people used to call her Big Gert. People stopped eventually, though. As they say, res ipsa loquitur. Latin, that is, means the thing speaks for itself. By the way, people also used to call Gert the thing. Anyway, Gert is the only person who eats and drinks for free here at the Rotted Stump. Would you like to know why?"
Martin didn't know how to answer. Pete saw his uncertainty and clarified.
"You'd find out by me telling you a story, not by Gert demonstrating her methods."
"Oh,"
Martin blurted.
"Then yes, I'd like to know."
The innkeeper explained.
"One day, Gert comes in here and announces, much like you did, that she wants food and a bed. And like you, Gert has powers. Far less mysterious powers than you claim, but powers nonetheless. Where Gert's approach differed from yours is that she just went ahead and demonstrated her power. She demonstrated her power on that table."
The innkeeper pointed at a heavy oak table that had been broken in half, then crudely braced and nailed back together.
"Then she threatens to continue demonstrating until I give her what she wants. It's in my interest to keep Gert happy by feeding her. It's in Gert's interest to keep me happy by not causing me trouble and not letting anyone else cause me trouble. Do you mean to cause trouble, young wizard?"
"No,"
Martin said, still looking up at the face of Gert.
"I won't cause trouble, but I can show you something you've never seen, something that will amaze. That's gotta be worth dinner and a bed."
The innkeeper smiled.
If you can show me something that will persuade me to give you free food and a bed that isn't you smashing an oak table with one blow, I will indeed be amazed.
They laughed openly. Gert went back to her seat. The innkeeper stood aside. Everyone was watching Martin to see what he'd do next.
Good people!
Martin declared, surreptitiously reaching his left hand into his pocket.
Customers of the Rotted Stump, mark this moment well, for one day you will gather your grandchildren round and tell them of the day the great wizard Martin the Magnificent showed you cloth you can see through!
He produced the evidence bag from his pocket with a flourish, holding it above his head with both hands. All laughter stopped. The customers slowly approached Martin and the plastic bag. They had never seen anything like it. He lowered it so they could get a good look.
"I'll hand it to you, lad,"
the innkeeper said, examining the plastic as Martin held it tight.
"That is something."
An old man poked at the bag with the end of his pipe, watching it deform under pressure.
"Will it hold off water?"
"Yes,"
Martin said.
"It lets light through, but it keeps water out."
The innkeeper gave Martin a searching look.
"Can you make more?"
"Yes,"
Martin said.
"I can."
"I'll tell you what. If you make more of this, say a few square yards, you'll have a place to sleep tonight."
"You'll trade room and board for the see-through fabric?"
"No, but I'll lend you a stick and you can make a tent."
A slightly raised voice called out from the door.
"Hello, Pete. I'm told I may be of some assistance."
All eyes turned to the door. There stood a man of average height and slightly heavy build. He had a neatly trimmed beard, keen eyes, and the bearing of a man who knew exactly what he was doing. He wore a flowing powder-blue robe with flared sleeves, which was by far the cleanest garment in the building, and a pointed hat that matched the robe perfectly. He held a polished wood staff. At the top of the staff, lashed with twine, there was a curved bottle full of some thick red fluid, stopped with a cork.
"Aye, Philip, thanks for coming,"
the innkeeper said, smiling.
"I believe an introduction is in order. Lad, Philip here is a powerful wizard and friend of the house being me. Philip, this lad claims to be a powerful wizard, and suggests that I should give him dinner in bed."
Philip, the wizard, bowed.
"Always a pleasure to meet another practitioner of the unknowable arts. You have the advantage of me. I am Philip. What's your name?"
"Damn right I have the advantage of you,"
Martin thought. He had this wizard figured out. The friendly words, the confident demeanor, the impressive robe. It was all classic con artist stagecraft.
"Says his name is Martin the Magnificent,"
Pete the innkeeper said before Martin could respond.
"Ah, very pleased to meet you, Martin."
The wizard bowed again, more deeply. His eyes caught the plastic bag.
"Oh my, what is this?"
"He calls it see-through cloth,"
Pete said, again cutting Martin off.
"Says he made it."
"Indeed,"
the wizard said, his eyes wide with wonder.
"Might I please see it more closely, Martin?"
Martin didn't want to hand him the plastic bag. Who knew if he'd give it back? He could always zip back to modern times and get more plastic. But if this Philip person made off with the bag, he'd have given the charlatan another tool to use in conning these rubes into believing he was a wizard. Martin didn't want that on his conscience. He held the bag up closer to Philip, but kept a tight grip. Philip smiled and poked at the plastic with his forefinger a few times.
"Impressive. Clearly you are a wizard of prodigious power, Martin. Tell me, can you make more?"
"Don't bother telling him to make himself a tent, 'cause I already did,"
Pete said.
"I was sure you'd already covered that, Pete. No, I just wanted to see him produce more of this wondrous material. It's always a pleasure to see another wizard work. Perhaps I might learn something. How about it, Martin? You made this cloth you can see through. Can you make more?"
"Of course I can make more. Anytime I want,"
Martin said.
"Splendid!"
but I can't do it while people are watching."
This caused some laughter, but Philip raised a single hand and silenced it instantly.
"Of course I understand. There are things we wizards are required to do that are not for others' eyes to see. It was unfair of me to ask that he conjure more transparent cloth right here in front of us."
Martin exhaled, happy that he had dodged that bullet.
"We shall have to find him a private place in which to work."
Gert threw Martin into a small room filled with casks and slammed the door behind him. It was dark, humid, and musty. Beyond the door, Martin could hear the wizard and the innkeeper, his captors, talking.
"He'll have no light in there."
"Oh, he shouldn't need any. They are called the dark arts, after all."
"And what if he can't produce any more of the cloth he can see through?"
"That would mean he's a liar. So naturally, we take all of his belongings, smear him with dung, and chase him out of town."
Martin had a vision of himself in filthy, torn clothing, fleeing into the woods while Philip went through his former belongings and happened across his smartphone. It was an awful thought, but Martin knew it would not come to that. Of course, he could just teleport out of here, but then what? No, he had to demonstrate that he was a wizard and shut up this con man. Once that was done, things would be much easier. Martin turned on the smartphone. Its screen lit up the room.
"I think I see a faint glow under the door,"
the innkeeper's muffled voice exclaimed.
"See?"
the wizard said.
"I think we'll find this Martin is quite resourceful."
"You don't know the half of it," Martin thought.
Walter and Margarita Banks stood, bewildered, in the kitchen of their house in suburban Seattle. Their youngest son, Martin, had just burst in, hugged them both, and told them, "Just remember, I love you, and it isn't true." As Martin walked toward his old bedroom, Margarita asked,
"It's not true that you love us?"
Martin stopped.
"What? No, I love you. Something else isn't true."
"What isn't true?"
Walter asked. Martin said,
"You'll see soon enough. I'll be in my room,"
and retreated to his room, closing the door firmly behind him. Margarita and Walter looked at each other, confused. They heard sirens, which were getting louder. Walter slowly started walking toward Martin's room.
"Son,"
he said, loud enough to be heard through the door.
"Are you in some kind of trouble?"
He was almost to the door when it burst open. Martin ran out of the door and back to the kitchen. For some reason, he was wearing that stupid robe from his Halloween costume when he was in high school. Martin ran to the drawer next to the kitchen sink.
"Martin, what's going on?"
Margarita asked. Martin held up a package of cling film.
"Do you have any heavy duty? This stuff's too flimsy."
"In the cupboard under the sink. Why are you wearing your Snape costume?"
Margarita had to yell. The sirens were very loud now, as if the police cars had parked on the front lawn, which they had. Martin muttered,
"It's Malfoy. You always get that wrong."
As he threw open the cupboard, grabbed two boxes of heavy-duty cling film, and silently thanked his parents for shopping at a discount warehouse. He then went back to his old room. He shouted, "Thanks, Mom!" and closed his bedroom door just as he heard someone pounding on his parents' front door. Back in the storeroom of the Rotted Stump, Martin caught his breath. He felt a fresh pang of guilt over the stress he was causing his parents. He knew that to them it had been less than a minute since he burst in their front door, but to him it felt like his parents' home had been under siege by federal agents for several hours. There was nothing he could do about that now, though. He had problems of his own. Working by the dim light of his phone screen, Martin opened the two boxes of heavy-duty cling film. He set the rolls aside while he methodically tore and folded the cardboard boxes so they could be hidden in his pockets. He doubted they'd be of use, and he didn't think the people of this time would know what to make of them, but it felt foolish to leave any evidence lying around. Martin stood up and spread his arms. He was wearing his light jacket under his robe, and when he raised his arms, the robe billowed outward from his sides, exactly as he'd hoped. He picked up one of the rolls of cling film and pulled about a yard of the film off of the roll. He did not tear the exposed film off. Instead, he scrunched it into a sort of loose rope and fed it through the arm of his robe. He put the roll of film in the left exterior pocket of his jacket, where it would be hidden beneath his robe. He held up his left hand. He could see an inch of the cling film extending out of the cuff.
With his other hand, he tugged it, and with some effort, the film fed smoothly off of the roll and out of his sleeve. He fed the excess back into his sleeve. Martin giggled fiendishly as he put the second roll in his right jacket pocket and fed the film through his right sleeve. Pete, Gert, and Philip heard a knock on the storeroom door. Pete released the catch and swung the door open. Martin Banks didn't say a word. He acted like he didn't notice they were there. He walked back to the front of the inn's main room and held his arms aloft, with the backs of his hands facing the assembled audience. All conversation stopped.
I, Martin the Magnificent, the most powerful wizard in the place, have been challenged to prove my prowess by producing more of the cloth you can see through. Before I continue, I ask the one called Philip, can you produce the see-through cloth?
Philip stood smiling at the side of the room, next to Gert and Pete.
No, Martin, I admit I cannot. I look forward to watching you do so, that I might learn something of your methods. The day we stop learning is the day we stop living.
Yeah, you're about to learn, you fraud, Martin thought.
So be it, Martin bellowed. I will need two volunteers.
The audience shrank away from him and tried to avoid eye contact, because that's what audiences do. Martin said,
You! Yes, you! No, not him, you! Come on! I won't hurt you! Oh, all right then. How about you?
No?
Come on, I just need two people to help!
Okay, you two. Yes, right here in front.
Yeah, look at me!
Okay, don't worry, you don't even have to get up. Look, just stay there, I'll tell you what to do.
With that settled, Martin again raised his arms with the backs of his hands facing the crowd.
If it's the see-through cloth you want, and proof of my power you require, then I present you with both! Behold!
He put his hands together over his head, grabbed the two stubs of film that were poking out of his sleeves, and pulled them, spreading his arms. The crowd murmured. He extended his arm to the two volunteers in the front row, offering them the loose ends of film which extended from his hands.
Pull them, my friends! Pull them!
The two men pulled on the cling film, handing the excess to the people around them as it emerged from his sleeves. Martin kept up the patter to help sell the illusion.
Yes, pull! Behold! Pull and behold! I produce the see-through fabric as a spider spins silk. Only I do so from my hands, not my abdomen.
By the time the rolls ran out, the entire room was draped with wrinkled cling film. The audience examined the film, tugging it to test its strength and trying to pull it flat to look through it. Philip looked delighted, and Martin was confused. Philip approached Martin, clapping his hands.
Well done! I honestly don't think it would have ever occurred to me to do that. I really am impressed.
He shook Martin's hand vigorously.
I see a great future for you here. Look, forget getting dinner in a bed from Pete. You'll just end up with fleas, and that's from the dinner.
Aye!
Pete objected.
You know it's true,
Philip said, still shaking Martin's hand.
Come stay with me. I've got plenty of room and a big pot of stew. I think we have a lot to talk about.
Martin wrenched his hand free.
I'm not going anywhere with you. You just want me to tell you how I did it. You think it's a trick you can use to fool people.
The warmth drained from Philip's expression. His eyes darted around the room.
Look, he said quietly. We both know exactly how you did it, and now I think we should go back to my house and discuss it as two wizards.
Two wizards?
Martin sneered.
There's only one wizard in this room, one wizard, and another guy who's done a lot of talking.
Philip turned to all the other people in the room.
Look, you've all seen me work. Will someone please set him straight?
Something fascinating seemed to be happening on the floor, or the ceiling, or out the windows, any place but where the wizards were standing.
Who knew medieval peasants were so shy?
Martin thought.
Look, Philip, if that is your real name, I've demonstrated my powers. Let's see yours.
Philip put an unwelcome hand on Martin's shoulder.
Look, you made some transparent fabric. It was very nice, but don't kid yourself. That's nothing compared to a real wizard's power.
Martin brushed off his hand.
So you say, but I still haven't seen anything to prove it.
That's the way you want to do this? Really?
Philip asked.
Okay. I challenge you to a wizard's duel. We go outside, you do something to demonstrate your powers, and I warn you, it'll take more than transparent fabric. Then, if I can beat it, I do. Then, if you can beat that, you do, and we keep it up until one of us fails.
Moments later, Martin and Philip were standing in the street, with a large crowd lining both sides. It was dark, but not so dark that Martin couldn't see the look on Philip's face, even from 30 feet away. Martin was set to go first, and that was fine with him. He was supposed to start small, but he'd open with levitating. There was no way the fraud could top that. He'd slink away in shame and leave town, most likely. Maybe Martin would get his hut. It sounded nice, and some stew would hit the spot. He saw Gwen in the crowd. He smiled and nodded to her. She shook her head, walked to Philip, and said something. Martin couldn't tell what from this distance, but Philip nodded as he replied. She looked to Martin again, her large brown eyes looking equally tired and disapproving.
"When do we start?" Martin asked.
"Whenever you're ready,"
Philip sighed. Martin pulled his phone out of his pocket. It cast what he hoped was an eerie glow on his face. The crowd silenced instantly. He opened the app. His thumb paused over the hover button. He paused for effect, then pressed the button. Instantly, he was suspended 3 feet in the air. He heard sounds of surprise from the gathered throng, but not quite as many as he expected. He figured most of them were too shocked to speak. The hover app worked as designed, resetting his altitude back to 3 feet off the ground 10 times a second. He tested it briefly in his apartment, curled into a ball to keep from putting his head through the ceiling. But now he was in a standing position and holding his altitude for more than a second or two. It was profoundly uncomfortable. Imagine standing in a bus with no shock absorbers, driving over cobblestones at 40 miles an hour. Every joint in his body rattled. His teeth hurt. His brain hurt. He feared he might be sick. He feared the vibration might break his phone, his only means of returning to his own time. He loosened his grip on the phone as much as he dared, hoping to dampen the shaking. Despite all this, he did not land. He had to expose the false wizard Philip, and that meant decisively demonstrating his superior power. He would stay in the air until Philip admitted he could not do better.
"Behold!"
Martin bellowed in a voice that sounded like he was yelling through a high-speed fan. Even to himself, he sounded like a goat.
"Philip, can your powers match this?"
He hovered in as impressive a pose as he could muster, with his body ringing with pain. All eyes turned to Philip, who smiled, shrugged, and said, "Let's see." Philip pointed his staff at the sky. The staff glowed an unearthly blue color and emitted a hum, like a kazoo, but with more reverb. Smoothly, effortlessly, Philip soared straight up, 30 feet into the air, his feet dangling beneath him. The blue glow formed a vapor trail that traced his path through the air. The buzzing intensified as Philip twirled the staff like an oversized baton. He spun the staff so quickly that it became a disc of blue light warping around him. Slowly, Philip started rotating. As he rotated faster, the blue disc became a blue sphere, which got brighter and hotter until it was burning a brilliant white. Despite it being well after dark, the street looked like it was high noon on the hottest day of the year. A voice so loud that it would have given Martin a headache, if he hadn't already given himself one, filled the air. The monstrous voice asked,
"What do you think, Martin? How's this?"
Without a word, Martin turned and ran as fast as he could. It would have been an impressive display of speed if his feet were touching the ground. He spun sickeningly and toppled over. He came to a rest hanging upside down at an undignified angle, facing Philip, still vibrating, 3 feet above the ground. His robe flapped downward. His feet kicked impotently in the air. Then Martin threw up. The white sphere of light contracted to the size of a basketball at the pinnacle of Philip's staff.
Philip was motionless, floating in the air serenely, with his staff held at his side, the ball of white light emitting from its tip, illuminating the whole world.
"Thanks for visiting us, Martin,"
Philip said in a flat, conversational tone.
"I'm sure we'll meet again, soon."